Welcome to E Pluribus Unum, the podcast where we dive deeper into the hive mind. I'm Josh.
And I'm Eric.
And today we're going to be talking about episode 2 entitled Pirate Lady.
Pirate Lady.
This one goes over Carol as she meets the other 5 immunes that also speak English, and the first meeting between the remainder of humanity that is no longer a part of the hive mind. Much like the first episode, and I know we had mentioned this in our previous episode of the podcast, we open up with another really brilliant Vince Gilligan cold open. This one reminded me of Breaking Bad, when the twin Mexican assassins are crawling along the ground up to some sort of altar that they pray to. This one very much had that same tone and similar vibe to it as we're introduced into this episode and introduced to the newest character here. We start up in Morocco as this person is cleaning up the dead bodies after the joining, as we find out it's called. And we follow this person as they hop on a plane and then they're heading somewhere, an unknown destination. All of the hive mind is working around this person as they're taking this journey to their destination, so much so that when this character arrives, who we find out is named Zosia, she is going in to take a shower, and all of the hive mind are getting her clothes and her makeup ready. And the whole time you're just wondering, what does this have to do with the story that we've been told so far? And of course we find out, but just giving you that introduction mystery is such a Vince Gilligan thing to do, and a really great way to open an episode.
And the other thing is, this entire opening sequence has no dialogue. There's no conversation with all of the interaction. And the interaction, again, is extremely unsettlingly fluid. It's like watching a perfect process. You're like, oh, that's really satisfying when that happens, you know? It also illustrates the thing about how each of these hive mind characters can do anything. She's first walking through the desert. She goes to pull a body out of a car. She goes to drive a scooter, then she drives to the airport and jumps into a gigantic plane and apparently is also able to fire it up and take off and then land in Albuquerque. Then it shows that it's sort of like a Matrix scenario, that not only are their minds connected and not only are their memories connected, but they can share those skills.
You bring up a really great point about they're doing all of this without speaking a word. There's no dialogue in this opening scene. And I think that goes back to our previous conversation that we had about episode 1, where we're talking a lot about language. And it's almost as if language is sort of the crutch that humans use for connection. Whereas when you're a hive mind, there's no need for language. There's no need for speaking even. Is language a portion of what makes us an individual? Is that a portion of how we bring our thoughts into the public conscious as well? There's a lot to think about there when it comes to not only their mentioning of things like Finnegan Wake in the previous episode, but the complete lack of almost interaction that these characters have since they are a part of one mind.
In the next scene is when she wakes up on the floor. It's that shot of the close-up of the liquor bottle that is half empty, lying on the floor, and it's slowly dripping onto the floor. And I'm a huge film noir junkie, and it just immediately reminded me of a sort of film noir, the drunken detective waking up the next day and having to contend not only with the headache and the hangover and such, but the results of the previous day.
And of course, the first thing that she lays eyes on is the body of her dead lover, which of course is another very noirish style of opening up this episode and jumping right back into where we left off with Carol as well.
And it leads us to the center part of this particular episode. To summarize it, Carol realizes that she has to bury her partner, and we go through this series of scenes that she makes the attempt to do that. And in the midst of trying to bury her partner, we finally get introduced to Zosia. And Zosia wants to just give her a bottle of water.
And she has some really great lines around that. She says, we believe you're about to suffer from heat exhaustion, and every doctor in the world thinks so.
It's funny and unnerving again, right? Yeah. It crosses that line in such a great way. But what really sells it Zosia's fairly stoic. She does smile a lot and she uses her eyebrows and things like that. And as the episode goes on, she emotes more, I think. But it's really Carol's face. Carol's reaction to the behavior of the people that are joined, it's art. Just her reaction to the bottle of water. She pours it out on the ground and Zosia's just like, I hope you have water in the house. We just want you to hydrate and take care of yourself. And just the vitriol that is in Carol's face of, I hate you. I want you out of my face. I want you out of my yard. I want you out of my life. And she tries to get rid of Zosia. And of course, Zosia wants to leave. It seems like the joined definitely want to please you. Like they said the night before, the neighbors were like, oh, you don't want us here? Oh, we'll leave. And the entire neighborhood leaves. And Zosia's like, oh, you don't want me to be here? Okay, I can leave. No problem. I want to make you happy. I want to appease you or please you. And that is definitely a theme, as you had mentioned in the first episode, that I think rings throughout, but it rings in a darker sense. This leads us to Carol actually, as Zosia's leaving, confronting Zosia out in the cul-de-sac. And this is both, again, a funny scene and a dark scene.
Yeah, I really love how Rhea Seehorn played this particular portion because it plays to a bit of a comedic effect where she gets really close to Zosia's face and is almost inspecting her as if she recognizes something. And then she goes back inside and grabs one of her romance novels and comes out and sees that indeed Zosia looks very much like the main love interest within her romance novels, who is named Raban. Almost as if they found this person in Morocco that happened to look like the male character in her book, Raban. Carol, seeing that the hive mind has sent a female version of this main character to her to almost manipulate her or just to make her feel a little bit safer or have a safe face to speak to. Yet we find out that the only other person that would have known that Raban was initially supposed to be female is her dead partner, Helen, who she's burying in the backyard right now. So we find out that the hive mind was able to induct Helen's consciousness before she died. Back in episode one, right before Helen passes away, she gives a real creepy smile to Carol right before she kicks the bucket. And we find out, of course, that wasn't necessarily Helen's smile. That was the smile of the hive mind. And you mentioned prior a bit about sort of Carol's rage and Carol's anger and Carol's hatred, really, to this hive mind. This is the first scene where we find out that rage and that hatred has a physical toll as well.
I think this might be the most pivotal scene in this episode. And this is an episode of pivotal scenes. So that becomes a real marker. I'll also say when this moment happened in the show, I literally cheered because you can go into this scenario thinking that there's no way around it, that you are one of a dozen people that aren't part of this group, and this group's trying its darndest to make you part of it. It's almost sort of inevitable, and it gives you this moment of, oh, I do have a weapon with which to fight, and maybe this can be rather powerful. And also the way that they illustrated it becomes very powerful. And you bring up this really great point, and this is where we are, and this is why I think it's so important to talk about this scene. Carol is so smart to think not, oh, this is really great and I feel very comforted by it. It's very much the total opposite of that. And she screams at her and she says, you ghouls, you grave robbers. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I felt in that scenario, but I didn't have the words for it. And I thought, how succinct and how clear and how true. You're using my partner's memories that were exclusive to the two of us to try and charm me? How disgusting. How disgusting are you? And I really appreciated that because we come across a scenario later in this episode that is the opposite of that. And it's almost enraging to me, to be frank. But because she gets so upset and she literally screams, you're ghouls, you're grave robbers, and she pushes her up against the car. And now Zosia is having an episode. She starts to have a seizure. And Carol's like, oh, oh my God, I'm sorry. Are you okay? And she just slides down the truck and is just lying on the ground, seizing. And Carol's screaming around like, is anybody around?
The hive mind produced Zosia to essentially calm Carol down. And they thought that this would be a pleasurable face to look upon that could help ease some of her fears. There's also something alien about that, right? Because us as normal people, if we were to see that, that's very off-putting to us. And it feels like we're being manipulated, you know? So it's almost as if in becoming this hive mind, have they lost their humanity? And that does every person on Earth put together not even resemble a human anymore? Then they can't even think in the way that a human would, because they've done something very unnerving at this point. And they didn't even recognize that that might not be the best thing to do for Carol. And all of the things that have been added to becoming a hive mind, is there something that's taken away? Is there a piece of humanity that's taken away by becoming the hive mind as well?
I think I want to piggyback off of that for a couple of reasons. Once again, not only do we see a hole in their plan where if Carol gets angry enough that there is a physical reaction in someone who is joined, but also the lack of knowledge of if they were to approach her in this way, that this was absolutely the wrong way to do it. Mm. And they don't discover that until after the fact. And if you notice, there's a lot of sequences as we move on where they discover after the fact that their thought process was absolutely wrong. And she points it out. Mm-hmm. She points it out in her very cynical but definitive way. And this is one of those instances. She's like, no, this was a terrible idea. And they're like, oh, we're sorry, Carol. And then they try to find some way to fix it whenever this kind of thing happens. It becomes a pattern. And it goes again to your concept of alien, right? They're not from Earth, or this RNA isn't from Earth, or this resequencing doesn't know about the cultures of Earth in the way that seem obvious to the rest of us. But it is able to do other things, like, again, be either a heart surgeon or an airplane pilot or whatever at any given instance. So in as much as it's consciousness or a shared hive mind, it almost seems computer, even less human, in a way that we would think of an alien overtaking or something like that. And I also wonder, just to kind of go back to it, because I'm a nerd, the time sequencing through the show. This time sequencing has something to do with what's going on here. And I'm wondering if it's also hinting towards something like that. And I find that fascinating as far as how the theories might play out. But super important scene in Act Two there. And it leads us to Carol saying, hey, are there other people out there in the world that are like me, that are unaffected by the joining? And Zosia says, yeah, there are some people out there that are experiencing the same thing you are.
Yeah, we find out that there are indeed, I believe, 12 or possibly 13.
When she is in the backyard telling her, yeah, there's 12. When she takes her later on to go meet them, she says, oh, by the way, there's one more that we just found today. And so they've added one to it.
And I think one thing that he's accomplishing here by doing that is really exemplifying that the hive mind isn't omnipresent, right? As much as we might think it is, it's only based on if there is a person of the hive mind there. They're not omnipotent, right? They're very much still a organism that are attached through these nodes, I guess you could call it, but it's not an omniscient being by any means. So there are things that they don't know. We even heard that briefly in the first episode, that the hive mind doesn't necessarily know why there are these 12 or now 13 immunes that are out there in the world, and possibly even more. And then we find out that, again, bringing language back into it, that there are 5 other immunes that speak English so that Carol can communicate with them. And it brings a really cool scene where she asks Zosia if they can all come together. And Zosia gets a very far away, sort of distant look, as if she's talking to someone else in her head. And Carol gets a bit worried and is asking, you know, what is happening? Are you still there? And then Zosia clicks back into reality here. And she says, they all said yes.
And then again, the look on Carol's face, the look on Rhea's face, the disbelief, shock, and also impressed at the same time. Just the reaction she has with that is so good, and it sells it 110%. The next scene is also, again, that sort of funny Vince Gilligan humor. They're on this gigantic plane, Carol sitting all the way in the back, and who's flying the plane? A waitress from TGI Fridays. And this is what Carol harps on. It's not anything else at all. She's just like, you just need to pay attention to, who's that lady? She's from TGI Fridays flying the plane. Yeah, you should pay attention to that. But it illustrates again to her and to us the concept of, if you know it, I know it. And that transferable skill is, to me, sinister, because it could go sideways very quickly. But they play it in the opposite way. Again, it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but instead of everybody being evil, everybody is happy. And so now they're forcing almost their happiness onto you. And they're forcing this happiness onto the most cynical person on the planet.
And this scene brings up a really great line from Zosia as well. She asks Carol, are you sure you want to do this? And Carol asks Zosia, why? You know, why do you ask that? And Zosia responds with, we can't protect you from each other. And I thought that was almost a haunting line from Zosia, and an uncharacteristically dark line coming from the hive mind at that point.
Well, it's subtly sinister, right? And you know, this line also, we need to reflect back on the previous scene where it's the two of them speaking again after Zosia had had the breakdown in the cul-de-sac. She comes back to help Carol. And Carol asks, did that affect everybody, or you? How many people did that affect? And Zosia says, everybody that was joined was affected by your emotional outburst. And she says, why is that? She goes, for some reason, because you're not joined with us, when you have a high emotional outburst, it has an adverse effect on us. So it's very clear in that moment that they want to define this as a thing. And she asks, well, how many people did I hurt? Because, you know, when she went to go seek help, she saw that one guy was hanging from man lift and another woman had obviously fallen and her face was hurt. She's like, how many people did I hurt? And it's interesting because Zosia will hold back on things she doesn't want to tell you. She will reluctantly tell you because you want to know and she wants to please you, but she will hold back if she feels like there's some negative stuff going on here. And in this instance, she's like, kind of like, you know, almost like a little kid, like, And she's like, well, how many, you know, five, six, a dozen. And Zosia's not saying anything. And she goes, hundreds. And Zosia still doesn't say anything. And then she says, thousands. And you could see Zosia just slightly move her head. And Carol gets sick immediately, just with the weight of thinking that her emotional outburst literally cost the lives of thousands of other people in this moment. And this becomes important later too.
And I think the emotional outbursts affecting the hive mind goes back to the line in the first episode of they're connected by what he calls a psychic glue. And we see that even in the first episode, all of these hive mind beings are putting out good energy, right? They're the helpful kids next door, or the folks in the very first scene of the hive mind saying, we're just trying to help Carol. So we see that they're putting out a certain wavelength on the emotional spectrum. And when they get the opposite wavelength coming from Carol, it affects not only the person in front of you, but the entire hive mind as well. So they sort of feed off of that psychic glue and live on this emotional wavelength as well. It's incredibly interesting stuff, and a lot of things that I'm hoping we get a little bit more answer to down the line. So we arrive in Bilbao to where Carol meets four of the other five English-speaking immunes, as we'll call them here. And we get to see not only the four immunes, but they've also brought their families who have already become one with the hive mind. We see husbands and we see aunts and sons and grandmas, and they're introducing themselves as this individual is this particular person's husband. I think one thing in this scene that's evident is the other four immunes that we meet in this particular portion, they're not as distraught as Carol is. They're not as angry as Carol is about the circumstance. And not only that, but they still have a link to the hive mind itself, even though they're not a part of the hive mind. Their family is a part of the hive mind. And they've accepted the people in their family that are a part of the hive mind as if they're still their family. It makes you question yourself and think, if my family member had become a part of the hive mind, would I be as accepting as they are? Or would I be more like Carol and be more cynical where they're not that person anymore? And I don't know what it's become anymore. I don't know what it is that I'm talking to anymore.
This leads me to my favorite moment in this scene and my favorite moment in the episode. Again, I just want to give Rhea the Emmy for her scoff when she discovers the people behind them, because she's speaking to the four, introducing herself, and she starts to loosen up. And then she, again, this is another sequence where what's happening in the background is more important than what's happening in the foreground. And what's in the background are the family members. And she looks over her shoulder and goes, "Do you know who these guys are?" And then that's where they do the introduction. And when they're done with their introductions, she does a full 360 and scoffs. She goes, and that scoff is perfection. It is absolute perfection. And it explained everything in her whole thought process of this is like, yep. And that is absolutely what we don't want. And that's why it's so important for her to get these English speaking people that aren't joined separate into a room and have a conversation with them about their current circumstances.
I think this brings us to the next character introduction, as we find out that the final immune that speaks English is arriving and that his mode of transportation came a little bit late since he had a specific request. As we see Air Force One pull up outside and everyone goes out on the tarmac, and we meet a character by the name of Kumba, and he believes that Air Force One is going to be the best place for them to sort of convene and have their first immune meeting.
Most of the other folks we get introduced to that aren't joined are fairly average folks in their own little worlds. You know, whether their culture or their language, they seem like you and me, essentially. And Carol is sort of that too, but she just has the cynicism and all these other things. And then you have this guy, and he is almost in his own movie, essentially. He thinks he's really funny, charming, has something to say for everything, clever, all of those things. I myself found him quite annoying, even as we get toward the end of the episode, but I understood the idea behind his character and how they could utilize it. But flamboyant, we'll just say. He's a flamboyant character, obviously. He rolls in with Air Force One. My favorite part of this sequence is they're sitting at the table and he's talking about Air Force One, the movie with Harrison Ford. And he goes, "Well, actually what Harrison Ford did, he didn't actually leave the plane. He was actually hiding in the," and then they interrupt him. And I'm like, he's actually talking about Air Force One, the movie. It pleased me to no end. I thought that was really great.
Yeah, because we know as the hive mind is leaving that particular room, they turn off all of the listening devices at Carol's request. But with that little line that seemingly is just a piece of comic relief, is there a piece of the hive mind that has not left, just like Harrison Ford is in Air Force One? So that's certainly something to think about. And we don't know at this point if the hive mind has the capability to lie.
Are they capable of deception? They seem like they're not. They seem like they have to tell you the truth if you're insistent. Mm-hmm. And we find that out later too. And even earlier before, where she's like, how many, you know, eventually they will seemingly tell you the truth, but it's almost like they don't want to tell you the truth if they think it's going to hurt you in some way, whether it's your feelings or something else. In as much as they're not acting deceptive, they do exactly what they say they're going to do and they do it immediately.
Not only that, but if telling the truth hurts you, does the hive mind automatically decide to be deceptive at that point? Because it seems like their main prerogative is to not hurt anything, not only humans, but anything that's living, as we find out later. And one thing I wanted to point out specifically about Kumba as a character, I think he's brought in specifically to be the antithesis of Carol. We have Carol, who has 100% unequivocally decided to be against the hive mind, where we have Kumbaa, who has completely bought in and decided to not necessarily be a part of the hive mind, but to accept the world as it is and how it's become and to continue to live like this. And it brings up a curious question. I think that's something that will be explored a bit later in the season between these characters, is that we have some of the immunes who bought into the hive mind so much that one of the characters, she in fact wants to become a part of the hive mind. She would like to be brought into the hive mind and be with her aunt again. And I think the distinction there that I'm trying to make is I don't believe that Kumbaa is of the same mind as that young lady. I think he very much wants to be apart from the hive mind still, but he enjoys the world that the hive mind has created around him. He still wants to be an individual. And you can see in the way he acts and the way he talks, he very much thinks of himself as an individual. I think that possibly Carol and Kumbaa have more in common than is initially disclosed in this episode.
It creates a really good tension, and you make a great point. They are definitely totally opposite of each other and also are willing to challenge each other. And you have these really tight conversations between the two of them that I think are valuable. But they do have sort of a round table. They eventually ask the joint to go out onto the tarmac, and they're in the main office in Air Force One, and they have their little sit down. As Carol broaches the conversation, she says, "What are we going to do about this?" And at one point, Kumbaa just says, "Why?" Well, because you could see all the people at the table besides Carol have essentially accepted the situation as it is. But they also have something she doesn't have, and that's their families or their connections to the world. And I believe she may feel she's lost all of that except for her humanity. And that's why she's in part working so hard to, quote unquote, save humanity. Is she's talking about saving her own humanity, her own individualism, her own separation from the hive or the joined. I agree with you, though. I think it even comes up at some point, if you were given the choice to join or not join, do you still have that choice? And it'll be interesting how that actually plays out. And this is also where we discover that they've also let all the animals out of the zoos. And Kumbaa even says, "All dogs are off their chains. Peace on earth." And I found that really interesting because I don't know that it's the greatest idea in the world to let all the animals out of all the zoos or to let all the dogs off of their chains. And it'll be interesting to see what that decision from the joined becomes later.
And I think that brings up another interesting question. And that's, why are the animals not assimilated into the hive mind? And maybe it's just because assimilating animals into the human hive mind would have a lot of the humans recreating animal behaviors or something along those lines. But an interesting question on why the animals weren't assimilated, but we do find out that the hive mind itself has a very altruistic view of life in general, whether that's human or animal. They don't want an animal to be in a cage, and they don't want a dog to be on a leash. And of course, in the next scene when they're all having lunch, we find out that they don't even want to kill an animal to eat it. So they specifically say that they will not kill a chicken to cook it for you. And even when Kumbaa says, "Well, if I kill a chicken, will you cook it for me?" She does indeed say yes. So there is still that appeasement there at work. But you see, when Zosia replies to Kumbaa and tells him yes, that it's almost a bit of a moral quandary for her to answer that question.
Well, and she answers, "We will mourn the creature, but yeah, I'll cook it for you." And then he asks, "Are you vegetarian then, or do you eat meat?" She says it very interestingly. She doesn't say, "Yes, we're vegetarians." She says, "We prefer not to." Mm-hmm. I want to bounce back to the Air Force One, not to say nothing happens, but essentially she doesn't really convince anyone one way or the other. And the resolution in the scene is, she says, "Does anybody have any ideas they'd like to bring to the table?" And Kumbaa like crosses his fingers and says, "How does everyone feel about lunch?"
And the final thing I would like to add on to the Air Force One scene is we find out that during Carol's initial bout of rage to Zosha, another character, another immune by the name of Lakshmi, was driving in the car with her grandfather, who at that point, of course, was a part of the hive mind. And during the sort of repose that the hive mind had after Carol's bout of rage, Lakshmi's grandfather died while driving that car. So Lakshmi already dislikes Carol. And we find out from Lakshmi that not only was it the quote unquote few people that died, that's what Zosha had told Carol earlier in the episode, but 11 million people died when Carol had her initial bout of rage with Zosha. So just adding so much more of an expansive view on what is a very close quarters character story at the same time. The things that these six immunes are doing have global repercussions.
And in this scene, Carol also points out very eloquently the hypocrisy. And she asks, I think she almost has to ask three times when she really wants an answer from them from hard questions. How many people died during the joining? And they eventually answer over 800 million. And she goes, well, I guess you got to break a few eggs. Because she's pointing out the fact that, oh, you won't kill and you let animals out of the zoo and all these other things. But when you came here, you killed 800 million people. And Zosha's answer was, it is our biological imperative to do so. And I thought that was also terrifying and telling, but it was also an excuse.
Yeah. And I think it's 867 million people died within the joining there. And I believe that's over 10% of the population of the entire planet.
Right.
That's certainly breaking a few eggs for sure.
My question then becomes, where does this philosophy come from then? Because just because our minds are all glued together doesn't mean that we all collectively immediately agree on a specific philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
They're not asking you. And she even says at the dinner table, she goes, you didn't ask any of us. You didn't ask a single one of us if we wanted to do this. You just did it. And then that's where she says, well, this is our biological imperative and stuff. Okay, where does that come from? Whose biological imperative?
It could very well be the biological imperative of the human race at the end of the day. One of the reasons I enjoy the show so much is that it begs conversations like this. And that's what makes it so intriguing and what makes you hell-bent on watching this next episode. So I got to say, Vince Gilligan really is knocking it out of the park.
Absolutely. I still want to know where this collective philosophy came from, because there were humans on this planet that were more than fine with murdering other humans. So how do you get to a consensus with every person on the planet that through this collective psychic glue that we all agree that we're not going to kill anymore and we're not going to eat meat anymore? Who came up with the idea to even do that? That is also a question. Where does that even come from? I guess my question is, now that we've adjusted our DNA using this RNA, are we just saying now we're just going into our next evolutionary step of being a collective hive mind that is vegetarian?
My point of view on it is that the majority of badness or ill will or evil comes from a distinct lack of empathy. And a lot of folks out there suffer from a lack of empathy. But when you are pushed into a hive mind where everyone is everyone, the only response is empathy, because we are the same now. We are one. So the empathy is, at that point, intrinsic to humanity. Going back to what E Pluribus Unum means, out of many, one. Now we are one. Now all we know is empathy. And with that empathy comes the idealism of the hive mind. So I think that's where it comes from, knowing each other, knowing everything about every other person on the world, is the purest form of empathy. And that's why those feelings are no longer there.
You know, I can subscribe to that. I can see that as a possibility. I'll put it in that box for now. in the interest of time, let's kind of wrap the tail end of this bad boy up. They have lunch, and we have another opportunity where Carol gets deeply upset because of the hypocrisy that's at the table, and she goes storming off. And as she goes, it's great. It's like a cartoon. It's like that meme of Kid Rock making his way down the hill with his elbow swinging. And she literally ends up, you know, ass over tea kettle. And of course, the joined come and run over there to try to help her and rescue her. And because she's so agitated, her rage comes out again. And she gets really upset and starts screaming at them, so much so that, of course, they start to have their seizure. And of course, the joined family members at the dining table have their seizure as well. And that sort of wraps that scene up. Interestingly, we get this overhead shot of these joined people seizing around Rhea's character as she realizes, oh my gosh, I lost my temper again. The next scene, she wakes up in bed and she picks up the phone and dials zero, I guess, or something. And she's like, hi, Carol, how can we help you? And she says, are you okay? Like, she's actually concerned for Zasha's welfare. And she's like, we're doing perfectly well. And then she says, how badly did I upset the other five? And she says, all but one have left. And of course, it's Kumba. We have to mention also that Kumba is always surrounded by half a dozen, basically supermodel styled women. I find it super gross and also super weird for two reasons. Number one, it's just super gross and super weird. The other reason is these people are all joined.
Yeah.
And it's something that Carol points out earlier, and this is important, and I love this. When you speak to any of the joined, you're speaking to everyone on Earth that is joined. So if you're physical with one of the joined, you are physical, in a sense, with everybody else on the planet. And that could include your cousin, your gynecologist, the guy that you had a crush on in high school, and I'm like, when she says it out loud, because it's a thought you already have, you're like, ugh, yeah, no. But Kumba has no problem with this, apparently. And he has several women around, and it's insinuated that they are his harem. And at this point, the whole reason that Kumba has stuck around is to ask Carol, can I have or borrow Zasha? Mm. And you can see that they put this here for a reason. It's interesting, because I think it plays out at the very end. And that is, Zasha says, I can't make the decision because if I make the decision, I will hurt one of you. And I can't do that. And Kumba loves this. And Carol says, you know what? I don't care. Go. Mm. And so they leave. And the next scene is she's getting on one plane and they're getting on another. And she's looking out the window and she sees them boarding. And the last person to board is Zasha. And she does the movie trope of stopping and then turning and looking exactly at the window where Carol is, and Carol sees her and then slides the shade down for the window. And Zasha joins the rest of the people on the plane. But there's this wonderful moment again, and Rhea just nails this silent moment where she acts the entire thing with her face. In fact, the camera angle is over the seat in front of her, and you just see her eyes peeking out over the back of the seat. And the camera turns around and we get a little bit closer look, and she has an epiphany of some kind. We don't know what it is, but it's enough to make her leap up out of this seat and go running down the aisle and saying, wait. And there's this great scene that's the very last shot. It's like the John Cusack film where he has the stereo over his head. And she stands in front of this Air Force One with her arms splayed out. And she's like, stop. And then it goes to black. So she realized something and she felt compelled to get on that plane. And I think she realizes something about Zasha, and that we're going to find out in the next episode.
Yeah. And I think that brings us to a really great ending question here, is that look from Zasha as she turns back to look at Carol in the other plane. What does that mean to you? Is that look manipulation by the hive mind into thinking that Zasha wanted to stay with Carol so that they can get her a little bit more bought into the hive mind? Or is that a sign that there is still some individuality in the hive mind, and that Zasha wanted to look back specifically at Carol because she felt that as an individual. That whole glance back at Carol from Zosia is almost something that you would read in a fiction romance novel that somebody happened to write within this world. Very reminiscent of something that you would read and something that Carol might have written. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I hear your purple sand thoughts on this thing. And I like the perspective that they are possibly, again, and maybe not even maliciously so, using what they know about her to get her to do what they think is the right thing. Okay, let's say that that's what this is. If you have a majority of the people saying we shouldn't kill and we should be vegetarians or whatever and anything else of their philosophy, then let's roll with it. I would like to add a different spin to it, although I like yours. My spin is this. The person that actually looked back at Carol was her girlfriend in there, or her wife, or significant other, her partner, right? And that's my thought, is that it's Helen in there looking back, and that there is a sense of individuality and memory and all those other things. Here's what I think this episode is about. I think the episode is about family. And it was shoved in our face that everybody had either a sense of family, which is a majority of those that spoke English. And even with Kumba, he makes his own family with his harem. But with Carol, she didn't have that, except for Zosia, because Zosia, and everybody else too, has a part of Helen in them. But Zosia represents even more of that because of the characterization of Raban, and that Raban should have been female before, and maybe even Raban is modeled after Helen a little bit. So for me, I thought of it as more, that was the part of Helen looking back and saying, I hope this isn't the last time I see you, because I still have all that love and those memories and all those things of Helen. That's still Helen in there. Whereas for Carol, Carol has lost Helen because Helen's not standing right there in front of her. Are they ghouls? Are they grave robbers? Or are they people that are saying, hey, I'm still in here. You haven't lost me. And through Zosia, you can still be with me.
Well, I think that might be the best place to put a pin in this episode, as episode 2 of Pluribus, Pirate Lady, it was entitled. Is there anything else you want to add?
I think we've got it. I'm very much looking forward to the next episode. I like that it is episodic. I like that we have to wait for it. It gives us those opportunities to have a conversation between them and share our theories and thoughts. And like you said, it's very thought-provoking. So yeah, here's to episode 3. Thank you, fellow humans, for listening to E Pluribus Unum, where we cover the fantastic show Pluribus. We're looking forward to talking to you next week.